In part one of this series that continues today, we took a look at the concept, the claim, that the gospel narratives are largely drawn from pagan sources, and we saw the weaknesses of those claims. In part two, we took a look at the claims regarding textual criticism, regarding the textual variants in the New Testament, and the claim that they're so numerous that we can't trust the document, and we saw the weaknesses in those claims. Today we're going to look at yet another claim, another premise of the argument that the New Testament cannot be depended upon. We're going to look at the claim that the writers of the New Testament took Old Testament passages out of context and applied them to their Jesus in an attempt to prove that he was the Messiah. And they tried to force messianic meanings into Old Testament prophecies that were not messianic at all. And we're going to take a look at one example, and if we have time to get to them, some more examples. But I want you to turn with me to Matthew chapter 1 and beginning in verse 18, and let's see precisely what we're talking about here. Matthew chapter 1 and beginning in verse 18. This is how the birth of Jesus Christ came about. His mother Mary was pledged to be married to Joseph, but before they came together, she was found to be with child through the Holy Spirit. Because Joseph, her husband, was a righteous man and did not want to expose her to public disgrace, he had in mind to divorce her quietly. But after he had considered this, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a dream and said, "Joseph, son of David, do not be afraid to take Mary home as your wife, because what is conceived in her is from the Holy Spirit. She will give birth to a son, and you're to give him the name Jesus, because he will save his people from their sins." All this took place to fulfill what the Lord had said through the prophet: "The virgin will be with child and will give birth to a son, and they will call him Emmanuel," which means God with us. So here Matthew quotes the prophet, and he says this event, this virginal conception and birth of Jesus, took place as a fulfillment of this prophecy which is found in the book of Isaiah. And that the prophecy itself is found in Isaiah, the 7th chapter. So if you'll turn there with me. Am I getting some feedback here? Can you understand, hear me okay out there? Okay, sounds like a lot of feedback coming. But if you turn with me to Isaiah 7, we'll just continue. Isaiah chapter 7, and before we read the particular text that is quoted, let me give you a little bit of the context in which this text is found, this particular scripture is found. Assyria in those days was a powerful nation. To maintain their dominance, the Assyrians would establish a dependent or vassal relation with the surrounding lands, the neighboring lands. Assyria, with her military might, would offer protection to the neighboring lands as long as those neighboring lands paid or gave periodic gifts, known also as taxes. So as long as they made their payments, Assyria would provide military protection for them, and sometimes it worked out. If you had a weaker nation in the environs or in the immediate surrounding of Assyria, then it worked out all the better for them. So this was the arrangement. However, if one of the vassals should show signs of disloyalty to Assyria, then Assyria would intervene and remove the disloyal vassal and replace him with a loyal king. And of course, naturally, understanding that you have a big superpower next to you, you're a smaller land, a smaller nation, and if you're the king of that nation, you want to make sure that the Assyrians never see you as a disloyal king. If you want to guard and protect your land, because not only would they replace you, but they would also take large portions of your land and thus reduce your territory, or the territory that was formerly yours. And if all else failed, or that is to say, if further signs of disloyalty were shown, then they would occupy completely. They would intervene militarily and completely take over that particular land. So this is the arrangement that they had in those days. In the time of Ahaz, the king of Judah, Syria, called Aram here, and Israel, which was the northern territory, the ten tribes of Israel occupied the northern territory known as Samaria. So Syria or Aram and Israel and Judah were in the first stages of vassalage. That is to say, they were vassal states, and they were under the dominant power of the Assyrians. The problem was this, and this is the context we find this particular prophecy of Isaiah concerning the virgin giving birth. This is the context. The problem was this, is that Syria and Israel were planning a rebellion, and they wanted Ahaz, the king of Judah, to go along with them, to join them in this rebellion, but Ahaz resisted. He wanted to remain loyal to Assyria. So this created a problem, because Israel and Syria then began to mount their forces against Ahaz, and of course they couldn't come in and overthrow him, you know, go over the walls and overthrow it completely, but what they could do was drive him out and replace him, or depose him and replace him with another king. So they were threatening to do this, to replace him with a king that would go along with their rebellion. But then God shows us in this prophecy that he does not want Ahaz to join the kings of Israel and Syria in this rebellion, so he sends Isaiah to encourage Ahaz to maintain his policy of loyalty to the Assyrian king. Essentially, the message that Isaiah takes to Ahaz is this: be calm, don't be afraid, even though you're fearful right now, as it tells you right in the first verses of Isaiah, the 7th chapter. Don't be afraid, because these two kings, the Israelite and Syrian kings that you now fear, are not going to last much longer, because God is going to send the Assyrians against them. But you remain where you are. You don't side with them. So in that context, let's read beginning in chapter 7 and verse 10. This sets the stage for what is about to be said here. Isaiah chapter 7, verse 10. Again the Lord spoke to Ahaz, "Ask the Lord your God for a sign, whether in the deepest depths or in the highest heights." But Ahaz said, "I will not ask. I will not put the Lord to the test." This is not a statement of righteousness on the part of Ahaz. On the contrary, it just shows the spiritual immaturity and the fact that he had no comprehension of how to relate to God. Besides, you read the story of Ahaz elsewhere in the Bible, and you see indeed that he was not a righteous king. He promoted the worship of pagan gods and so forth, the use of idols. Verse 13, "Then Isaiah said, 'Hear now, you house of David, is it not enough to try the patience of men? Will you try the patience of my God also? Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. The virgin will be with child and will give birth to a son and will call him Emmanuel. He will eat curds and honey when he knows enough to reject the wrong and choose the right. But before the boy knows enough to reject the wrong and choose the right, the land of the two kings you dread will be laid waste. The Lord will bring on you and on your people and on the house of your father a time unlike any since Ephraim broke away from Judah. He will bring the king of Assyria.'" So what he's saying here, to sum it up, is that before the child is old enough to make decisions, mature decisions, then these two kings that you fear are going to be dealt with, because God is going to send the Assyrians into the land. Now, essentially, the prophecy is dated. It tells us that before he's old enough to make these conscious or these moral decisions or decisions regarding his life, right, knowing right and wrong and making proper decisions, that the land of the two enemies, Syria and Israel, will be laid waste. Now, here is Matthew. Here's the problem. We find Matthew in Matthew chapter 1 and verse 23, as we read a few moments ago, saying that all this took place when he's talking about the birth of Jesus some 700 years later. He says all this took place to fulfill what the Lord said through the prophet: "The virgin will be with child and will give birth to a son, and they will call him Emmanuel." How could that be? Do you see the problem? This was a prophecy that pertained to the time of Ahaz, 700 years or so before the birth of Jesus. And yet Matthew, as the critics claim, takes it right out of context and applies it to the birth of Jesus. Now, how does he get away with it? If you look at this at first glance, it does seem that the critics have made a good point, that Matthew is in fact lifting a verse out of its proper context and applying it to something that it does not apply to. In fact, the critics will tell you, this is not a messianic prophecy. this is not about the coming of the Messiah. It's a sign given to Ahaz that his enemies are going to be overthrown. And furthermore, when you look back at the prophecy, it says, when it says the virgin will be with child, it says in the Hebrew, the maiden will be with child. It means simply that some maiden, and the definite article, the maiden, is there in the Hebrew. It means that some maiden, and usually the term that was used applied to an unmarried woman, by implication virgin, but it doesn't technically mean virgin, but someone known to the royal household, at that time unmarried, but soon would be married and would then give birth to a child whose name would be Emmanuel, and this would be a sign to King Ahaz. So how do we explain this? Are the critics, are they making a pretty good point here? Do they make a good point when they say that Matthew lifted this right out of context and gave it a meaning that was foreign to the original meaning? If that's the case, then maybe we can't really trust the New Testament. But is that the case? First of all, something we need to understand. First of all, as we examine this issue, we need to understand about Matthew's use, and as far as that goes, the use of the Old Testament by the New Testament writers. Matthew was not proof texting when he quoted this text. He was not proof texting. We tend to proof text a lot. If we want to find a subject, we want to prove something one way or the other, then we'll go through the Bible and choose various verses that have to do with that subject and put them all together and draw some kind of conclusions, won't we? That's proof texting. Matthew was not proof texting in that sense. And second, and this is very closely related to the fact that he was not proof texting, Matthew's use of Old Testament passages was not a desperate attempt to prove that Jesus was the Messiah. You see, this is something that already the proof, as far as Matthew was concerned, and Mark and Luke and John, by the time they wrote, the proof was already there. It was well established. And it was in the fact that he rose from the dead and therefore proved that he was who he says he was. He was the Messiah. And also, there are many other people in that period believed that Jesus was the Messiah. They believed because of the work's sake. They believed because of the miracles. Not only because he fit the description of those messianic passages, but because of the great things that he performed, the great miracles that he performed. And ultimately, his being raised from the dead put the cap on it, you might say. It proved it thoroughly. So Matthew is not here in a desperate attempt trying to prove that Jesus was the Messiah. Actually, what he's doing is he's linking the events of Jesus' life with the Old Testament texts which pertain to the destiny of the Davidic dynasty. Matthew knows that every Old Testament text that pertains to the destiny of the Davidic dynasty is by its very nature messianic, meaning has to do with the Messiah. And you know what the meaning of Messiah is? Anointed one. It goes back to the fact that David was anointed as king over Israel, and the promise given to him is that his dynasty would continue forever, and that his descendants would also be anointed as kings after his death, until finally, of course, the ultimate Davidic king would come along, and that is the Messiah. So with this in mind, let's go back to Isaiah's prophecy and re-examine the text and put it in its larger context and see, in fact, that Matthew was not lifting anything out of its context and misapplying it, but in fact, he knew exactly what he was doing. Back to Isaiah chapter 7 once again, and again in verse 13. Then Isaiah said, "Hear now, you house of David." I want you to notice this. It's addressed to not just to Ahaz, who was a Davidic ruler, but to the house of David. The house of David. And when you read something that is addressed to the house of David, automatically the Davidic covenant, the Davidic promises, and the things that God said to David about his dynasty come to mind. Is it not enough to try the patience of men? Will you try the patience of God also? Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. And the term "you" in the Hebrew is in the plural, meaning he was not merely addressing Ahaz, but he was addressing the royal household. The royal household. The virgin, or the maiden, will be with child and will give birth to a son and will call him Emmanuel. He will eat curds and honey when he knows enough to reject the wrong and choose the right. But before the boy knows enough to reject the wrong and choose the right, the land of the two kings you dread will be laid waste. When it speaks of the virgin giving birth, As I said earlier, obviously it's talking about someone known in the royal household. There are a lot of different opinions on exactly who this was. Was Isaiah talking about one of his own sons? Was this a prophecy about Isaiah's son? Some commentators believe so. Others believe it was someone else. I'm not going to go into all of the arguments, but because it is addressed to the house of David or the royal household, and it does seem to pertain to a royal heir, then I'm going to, my opinion is that he's talking about Hezekiah. We don't have time to go into all the reasons, but I believe he's talking about Hezekiah, King Hezekiah. Now, with this in mind, since it does pertain to the royal household, whether Hezekiah or someone else, I do believe Hezekiah, let's go on and look at another prophecy that is in the same context. Turn over to chapter 9. Turn over to chapter 9. And beginning in verse 2, the people walking in darkness have seen a great light. Of those living in the land of the shadow of death, a light has dawned. You have enlarged the nation and increased their joy. They rejoice before you as people rejoice at the harvest, as men rejoice when dividing the plunder. For as in the day of Midian's defeat, you have shattered the yoke of that burden, or the yoke that burdens them, the bar across their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor. Every warrior's boot used in battle and every garment rolled in blood will be destined for burning and be fuel for the fire. For to us a child is born. Keeping in mind what we just read about a child named Emmanuel, which means with us is God. To us a child is born. To us a son is given. And the government will be on his shoulders. Now, you can check a number of commentators, certainly Jewish commentators would agree, at least some of them, that this is still talking about the same thing, and it is talking about the reign of King Hezekiah. And he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. These titles belong, as far as their fullness, the fullness of their meaning, belong in another sermon. But one thing is for sure, and we'll see this when we look at the example of Hezekiah a little bit later, one thing is sure is that Hezekiah's reign reflected the fact that God himself, or that he is the mighty counselor, or his reign reflects the mighty counsel or the wonderful counsel of the mighty God. So the counsel of God can be seen in the reign of Hezekiah. Keeping these things in mind now as we go on. Of the increase of his government and peace, there will be no end. He will reign on David's throne. And over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever. The zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this. So here we see, and keep in mind, we're talking about a preliminary fulfillment, not the finality yet. But this is definitely has some, and to some extent, pertains to the reign of Hezekiah. With the same context in mind, go over to chapter 11 now. Chapter 11, keeping in mind, I should say, that this is the same context in which this is given, same context historically. Chapter 11, verse 1. A shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. Jesse was the father of David. Again, this is concerning the Davidic dynasty, the Davidic ruler that is to come and to restore things. From his roots, a branch will bear fruit. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and of understanding, the Spirit of counsel and of power, the Spirit of knowledge and of the fear of the Lord, and he will delight in the fear of the Lord. He will not judge by what he sees with his eyes or decide by what he hears with his ears, but with righteousness he will judge the needy. With justice he will give decisions for the poor of the earth. He will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth. With the breath of his lips he will slay the wicked. Righteousness will be in his belt, and faithfulness the sash around his waist. And then it goes on to describe the conditions of that period of time. But notice down in verse 10, in that day the root of Jesse will stand as a banner for the peoples. The nations will rally to him, and the place of rest will be glorious. In that day the Lord will reach out his hand a second time to reclaim the remnant that is left of his people from Assyria, from Lower Egypt, from Upper Egypt, from Cush, from Elam, from Babylonia, from Hamath, and from the islands of the sea. He will raise a banner for the nations and gather the exiles of Israel, talking about northern Israel taken into exile. He will assemble the scattered people of Judah from the four quarters of the earth. So this is saying that this king, this Davidic ruler, will gather the people, not only the people of Judah, but will reach out to the outcasts of Israel and bring them in and reconstitute them as one nation. Now, as I said, Hezekiah fulfills to some limited extent the things that are presented in this series of prophecies. And I like to think of this series, beginning in chapter 7 and continuing through chapter 11, as the Emmanuel promise or the Emmanuel mission. But the question is, did Hezekiah completely and finally fulfill the Emmanuel mission? Let's go back to the book of 2 Kings and take a look at the example of Hezekiah, see what it says about him, and I believe we'll be able to answer that question. Back in 2 Kings, beginning in chapter 18 and verse 1, in the third year of Hoshea, son of Elah, king of Israel, Hezekiah, son of Ahaz, king of Judah, began to reign. He was 25 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem 29 years. His mother's name was Abiah, daughter of Zechariah. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, just as his father David had done. Of course, this cannot be said of his father Ahaz, because he didn't do what was right in the eyes of the Lord. He removed the high places, smashed the sacred stones, and cut down the Asherah poles. He broke into pieces the bronze snake Moses had made, for up to that time the Israelites had been burning incense to it. Verse 5, Hezekiah trusted in the Lord, the God of Israel. There was no one like him among all the kings of Judah, either before him or after him. He held fast to the Lord and did not cease to follow him. He kept the commandments the Lord had given Moses, and the Lord was with him. He was successful in whatever he undertook. He rebelled against the king of Assyria and did not serve him. From watchtower to fortified city, he defeated the Philistines as far as Gaza and its territory. 2 Chronicles chapter 29 tells us more about this remarkable king of Judah. 2 Chronicles chapter 29. Here we learn that he reopened the temple. He repaired the temple. He assembled the Levites, and he had them to consecrate themselves and to consecrate the temple. In verse 35, we read, after this consecration took place, says, there were burnt offerings in abundance together with the fat of the fellowship offerings and the drink offerings that accompanied the burnt offerings. So the service of the temple of the Lord was reestablished. Hezekiah and all the people rejoiced at what God had brought about for his people because it was done so quickly. And then continuing on in chapter 30, verse 1, Hezekiah sent word to all Israel and Judah and also wrote letters to Ephraim and Manasseh. Now, didn't we read something earlier in the prophecy about this particular king, this root of Jesse, restoring or bringing back the outcasts of Israel? So he was a Judahite king, but he brings back the outcasts of Israel. So the point being here is that Hezekiah did, to some extent, and I'll add at this point a limited extent, but to some extent fulfill the prophecies given in the book of Isaiah concerning the Emmanuel mission, inviting them to come to the temple of the Lord in Jerusalem and celebrate the Passover to the Lord, the God of Israel. The king and his officials and the whole assembly in Jerusalem decided to celebrate the Passover in the second month. And of course, this was according to the judgment that was rendered back in the time of Moses as to when concerning the second month Passover. They had not been able to celebrate it at the regular time because not enough priests had consecrated themselves and the people had not assembled in Jerusalem. The plan seemed right both to the king and to the whole assembly. They decided to send a proclamation throughout Israel from Beersheba to Dan, calling the people to come to Jerusalem and celebrate the Passover to the Lord, to the God of Israel. It had not been celebrated in large numbers according to what was written. At the king's command, couriers went throughout Israel and Judah with letters from the king and from his officials, which read, "People of Israel, return to the Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, that he may return to you who are left, who have escaped from the hand of the kings of Assyria." Dropping down to verse 10, the couriers went from town to town in Ephraim and Manasseh as far as Zebulun, but the people scorned and ridiculed them. Nevertheless, some men of Asher, Manasseh, and Zebulun humbled themselves and went to Jerusalem. Also in Judah, the hand of God was on the people to give them unity of mind to carry out what the king and his officials had ordered, following the word of the Lord. It goes on to tell to summarize the story, that they observed the Passover, and it was a great feast, as they observed the days of unleavened bread following the Passover sacrifice. And it was so wonderful, so glorious, that the restoration was taking place, restoration of the worship of God was taking place, that they wanted to observe seven more days, so they added seven more days to it, to rejoice before the Lord their God. In dropping down to verse 25, chapter 30, verse 25, the entire assembly of Judah rejoiced, along with the priests and Levites and all who had assembled from Israel, including the aliens who had come from Israel and those who lived in Judah. So he reaches out to the Gentiles as well. There was great joy in Jerusalem, for since the days of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel, there had been nothing like this in Jerusalem. So this was definitely a restoration taking place. There was a certain fulfillment of the Emmanuel promises and mission taking place in the days of King Hezekiah, no question about it. The priests and the Levites stood to bless the people, and God heard them, for their prayer reached heaven, his holy dwelling place. So very clearly, this was at least a typological fulfillment of what was spoken from the beginning with the prophecy concerning Emmanuel, and continuing on through chapters 9 and through chapters 9 and 11 of Isaiah's prophecy. Well, as I said, we might call this section of Isaiah the Emmanuel promise or the Emmanuel mission. But what we must realize is that the Emmanuel mission was not accomplished in its final sense in the reign of King Hezekiah. As righteous a man as he was, and the great works that he did in restoring the worship of God for the people of Judah and inviting the people of Israel and even the aliens coming in, as great as he was, he did not fulfill the prophecy or the promise or the mission in its final sense. It will be accomplished in the righteous reign of the ultimate and final Davidic ruler. When Matthew links Jesus with the Emmanuel prophecy, he is saying, he's pointing to the child Jesus, he's saying, this is that Davidic ruler who will fulfill the destiny of the Davidic covenant. And that's his point. His whole point, as we're going to see not only in this sermon, but the sermons to follow in this series, that Matthew again and again links Jesus and the events of Jesus' life with those prophecies that have to do with the destiny of the Davidic dynasty. Matthew's use of the Emmanuel prophecy shows that he had a thorough understanding of the larger context in which the prophecy was given, unlike what his critics say. In fact, his understanding, I would say, was quite a bit more profound than any of his critics who condemn him for supposedly taking scriptures out of context. So you can see he was not out of context at all. He was simply applying the Davidic dynasty, the scriptures that had to do with the Davidic dynasty and its destiny, to Jesus of Nazareth. So let's go back to Matthew 1 now. Back to Matthew 1 once again and re-examine this passage and see some interesting things about it. Verse 22, once again, after describing the birth of Jesus and the revelation to Mary that she would conceive, says, all this took place to fulfill what the Lord had said through the prophet. The virgin will be with child and will give birth to a son, and they shall call him Emmanuel. You notice here Matthew uses a term, and if you're familiar with the Greek, the term does mean virgin. Interestingly, in the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Hebrew Scriptures, a term is used that is not ambiguous, as is the term in the Hebrew, which is translated maiden in some translations, but the term in the Septuagint means virgin. And Matthew is using the Septuagint and quotes it almost verbatim with a slight little change in wording toward the end of the verse. But he uses the term that means virgin. Some people will say, well, you know, what he's doing here, he's just choosing the translation that most fits his belief. And, you know, that's true. He was. Matthew links the fact of the virginal conception with the wording of the Septuagint simply because the term used in the Septuagint fits the actual event. Now, there's nothing dishonest about that. He's simply using the most appropriate terms in establishing a connection between Jesus and the Old Testament text dealing with the destiny of the Davidic dynasty. As simple as that. Now, with all of this in mind, I'd like to take a look at several scriptures that are either directly quoted or at least alluded to in the New Testament and see how they apply to the Messiah. Go back with me to 2 Samuel chapter 7. 2 Samuel chapter 7, and beginning in verse 12. God is speaking to David. The Lord declares to you, this is the latter part of verse 11, the Lord declares to you that the Lord himself will establish a house for you. Verse 12, when your days are over and you rest with your fathers, I will raise up your offspring to succeed you, who will come from your own body, and I will establish his kingdom. He is the one who will build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. Now we know that he's talking about Solomon. That Solomon is the one who would build the house, not David. David had a problem. He was a bloody man. God would not allow him to build the house. So he says, your son, who will follow you, will build the house for my name. And I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. Now, we can stop right there and say, well, this definitely applies to the Messiah, speaking of a kingdom that lasts forever. And yet, we look at verse 14. It says, I will be his father, and he will be my son. When he does wrong, I will punish him with the rod of men, with floggings inflicted by men. When he does wrong? You see, the problem here is, or at least the alleged problem, is that this cannot be a messianic prophecy simply because this speaks of someone who is doing wrong, or at least it cannot pertain to Jesus because the claim is that Jesus was without sin. So when he does wrong, I will punish him with the rod of men, with floggings inflicted by men. But my love will never be taken away from him as I took it away from Saul, whom I removed from before you. Your house and your kingdom will endure forever before me. Your throne will be established forever. Nathan reported to David all of the words of this entire revelation. You know, the first thing that's important to realize here is that this prophecy pertains to the Davidic dynasty. You see, it's a mistake to try to go back to the Old Testament and pick out the prophecies and say, well, this is definitely about Jesus specifically and exclusively. No, this prophecy is about the Davidic dynasty. It's about the son of David. And it is given in view of the promise that God gave to David regarding his dynasty and the everlasting nature of his dynasty, of his kingdom. So that's the first thing we have to realize. The second thing is that in these texts, we see a description. Even though you find a description of the possibility of this Davidic king going wrong and being punished with the floggings, the rod of men and floggings inflicted by men, what we have to realize is that we find descriptions in this and other prophecies which deal with the Davidic dynasty as a whole. We find descriptions of the ideal Davidic ruler. And therefore, we know that we can apply it directly to Jesus Christ, who is the ideal Davidic ruler. You follow what I'm talking about here? You know, you look throughout the history of Judah, and you find the kings from David onward, and you find that they had their problems. And because of their problems, God intervened, and it actually affected their kingship. In the case of David, he couldn't build the house he wanted to build. Even in the case of Hezekiah had a problem with pride, and so that affected his rulership. So in order for the Davidic king to completely do everything that is actually that the Emmanuel promise entails, then he must be perfect. In order for him to restore Israel and Judah as a single sovereign nation and to establish it as a kingdom and as a model nation of the world, which all the prophets describe and speak about, then he has to be a perfect Davidic king. So when we read through all the prophecies about David and his descendants, we do see emerging the ideal Davidic king, and therefore it can be and should be applied to the one who will do all of these things and finally and ultimately restore the kingdom. Let's go to several other passages. Jeremiah chapter 23, in verses 5 through 8. And keeping in mind that many of these scriptures, though they may have had certain fulfillments in the past, they may have had limited fulfillments, they still apply to the ideal Davidic king. Jeremiah chapter 23 and beginning in verse 5. The days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will raise up to David a righteous branch, a king who will reign wisely and do what is just and right in the land. Again, he's speaking of the Davidic dynasty. In his days, Judah will be saved and Israel will live in safety. This is the name by which he will be called, the Lord our righteousness. So then, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when the people will no longer say, as surely as the Lord lives who brought the Israelites up out of Egypt, but they will say, as surely as the Lord lives who brought the descendants of Israel up out of the land of the north and out of all the countries where he had banished them, then they will live in their own land. And this is talking about, it points to the ultimate restoration, which can only take place under the leadership of the ideal or perfect Davidic ruler. In chapter 33, skipping over many such prophecies, we go into chapter 33, we find another statement here, verse 14. The days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will fulfill the gracious promise I made to the house of Israel and to the house of Judah. In those days and at that time, I will make a righteous branch sprout from David's line. He will do what is just and right in the land. In those days, Judah will be saved and Jerusalem will live in safety. This is the name by which it will be called, the Lord our righteousness. And then in Psalm chapter 89, many, many other scriptures similar to this that we could go to, but let's turn to Psalm chapter 89 and take a look at this principle once again as to how it is that we can recognize messianic texts when we see them. Psalm chapter 89, and let's begin in verse 19. Once you spoke in a vision to your faithful people, you said, I have bestowed strength on a warrior. I have exalted a young man from among the people. I have found David, my servant. With my sacred oil I have anointed him. My hand will sustain him. Surely my arm will strengthen him. No enemy will subject him to tribute. No wicked man will oppose him or will oppress him. I will crush his foes before him and strike down his adversaries. My faithful love will be with him, and through my name his horn will be exalted. I will set his hand over the sea, his right hand over the rivers. He will call out to me, you are my Father, my God, the rock, my Savior. I will appoint him my firstborn and most exalted of the kings of the earth. I will maintain my love to him forever, and my covenant with him will never fail. I will establish his line forever, his throne as long as the heavens endure. If his sons forsake my law and do not follow my statutes, if they violate my decrees and fail to keep my commands, I will punish their sin with the rod, their iniquity with flogging, but I will not take my love from him. This is saying that even when God finds sinfulness in the house of David, in the line of David, and remember he promised David that his kingdom, his throne would endure forever. So when he finds sinfulness on that throne, then he says he will handle it. He'll deal with it. But the promise given to David will continue. He will be faithful to that. Nor will I ever betray my faithfulness. Verse 34, I will not violate my covenant or alter what my lips have uttered. Once for all I have sworn by my holiness, and I will not lie to David, that his line will continue forever and his throne endure before me like the sun. It will be established forever like the moon, the faithful witness in the sky. And we could go through many, many psalms. It's a good idea to just sit down and read the psalms. Read psalms that are written by David. Read psalms that reflect the mind of David. Read the psalms that, such as this one, that speak of God's promise to him. The psalms that speak of David's strengths and the strengths of his sons that followed him, of his weaknesses and of his sins. And as you read through these psalms, one thing will become clear. that even though you find the weaknesses and the sins there described in David and his descendants, one thing emerges very clearly, and that is an image of the ideal Davidic ruler. And therefore, that image can be rightly applied to the ultimate ruler who will restore Israel, who will regather the people of Judah and establish those people as the model nation of this world. And those prophecies, these statements, all of them, the combined total, and actually you can go back and start in the book of Genesis and continue all the way through the book of Malachi, and you'll find with all of this, with the material we've covered today and considering the broader context, you will find that the entirety of the Old Testament revelation, the central theme, is messianic. It is messianic. It points to the ultimate Davidic king. And this is just the beginning of the story. In the next part of this series, whenever I'm scheduled to speak here again, we'll take a look at some of those other prophecies that seem to be troubling for so many people, such as the prophecy in the book of Hosea, where God describes Israel as his son, and he says, I have brought my son out of Egypt. And yet we find in the book of Matthew that Matthew applies that to Jesus. How in the world did he do it? We'll leave that one for the next time.